Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most momentous events in that war in recent memory is what happened to America on 9/11. A man who was in the midst of both the events of that day and trying desperately to save those who were afflicted in New York City is an old friend of this program and mine, Tim Brown, a decorated 20-year veteran of the Fire Department of New York. He survived the attack. He was a first responder as well to the 1993 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, the first effort to take it down. He also responded to the attack on the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. Tim lost some 93 of his friends, including many among his fellow firefighters, on that horrible day we marked 17 years ago this week. Tim Brown, it's an honor to have you with us again. We revere your service to our country, both that you've rendered in the past and that you're continuing to render by helping the rest of us remember and learn from our past very bad experiences with which you've had to contend personally. Thank you so much for taking some time to join us.
Thank you, Frank. I'm happy to be with you.
I'd like to have sort of two discrete focuses to this brief conversation with you, Tim. One is just reminiscences. What is top of mind for you that should be, in your view, for all of us, as we reflect back on the events of this week 17 years ago? Your own personal involvement, but also those that you've learned of in the years since.
Yes. You know, on that day, 343 New York City firefighters, 37 Port Authority police officers, 23 New York City police officers, 8 EMT paramedics ran toward the towers and ran up the stairs. They were American heroes who knew the danger they were going into, but still went up anyhow. And when I speak about them, I say American heroes murdered by radical Islamic terrorists, because we need to know that that is the full truth. Truth in history means the whole truth in history. Yes, they were heroes. They were American heroes. They ran up. They saved the lives of some 25,000 people. But the people, we also have to speak about the people that did this to us and why they did it. And if we don't speak clearly about that, then we fail.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the things that has troubled me, and I know you, in this intervening, very difficult, horrifically costly, most especially in terms of lives as well as national treasure, intervening 17 years, have been the seemingly persistent failure to recognize the wellsprings of this, as you put it, and as President Trump has put it often, radical Islamic terrorism. And Tim, you and I have talked about this often over the years, that Sharia, the doctrine that impels jihad, is at the heart of this, is it not?
It is absolutely at the heart of it. It is the belief. It's basically Sharia versus freedom. That if you boil it all down, that's what it's about. And Sharia is incompatible with freedom here in America. And we have to fight for freedom just as others before us have fought for hundreds of years. We are in a generational a war. And we need to speak clearly about it. We need to speak clearly that America does not embrace Sharia. America is about freedom for all, personal freedom, freedom of religion, freedom of everything that we hold so dear. And when we start losing that, we start drifting away that we don't want to drift.
Again, amen to that. Tim Brown, one of the things that we're sometimes told is, well, you can't really object to the practice of Sharia in the United States because of that foundational freedom that you mentioned a moment ago, namely religious freedom. My own sense of this is that the religiosity involved in Sharia is kind of a veneer on what is fundamentally a doctrine about power and how people will be ruled and who will prosper and who will not prosper and the like, which, as you said, is totally incompatible with our Constitution, our freedoms, our values as a nation. Your thoughts?
Yes. I think Sharia is both things, because I think there are a lot of people that in America who practice some limited type of Sharia.
Yeah, specifically the religious, you know, practices of, you know, where you pray and how and, you know, in which direction and all that.
Yeah, that's the majority of Muslim Americans.
We certainly hope so. Yeah.
There are others that practice the political side of it, and that is exactly the opposite of freedom and what America is about. So we have to be able to be smart enough to distinguish these things.
Yeah. Again, you've captured this brilliantly. To the extent that we're now looking back at 17 years of war and efforts to contend with threats, both foreign and domestic, that have a lot in common with those that manifested themselves on 9/11 17 years ago. Tim Brown, if you were advising President Trump, for example, as you have in the past advised Rudy Giuliani and many others, what would your recommendation be about how we best address this problem of what I think of as Sharia supremacism so as to avoid further losses of the kind you personally experienced so vividly 17 years ago?
Well, we have to make, you know, as I just said, we have to make the distinction between the religious Sharia and the political Sharia. And we have to make it clear to our intelligence community, to our national security community. We have to educate them properly on the difference. And we have to enforce the Constitution of the United States. We have to enforce true religious freedom and call people out who are speaking out against it. We took over the last years, we've taken away in the training manuals for our national security, our military. We've kind of whitewashed this problem over, and we're moving away from what I say is truth in history, full truth in history.
Yeah, and policies based on them. This is really the crux of the matter. We are out of time. I'm so sorry to say, Tim Brown, but this is a topic that we've hardly scratched the surface of, and I appreciate so much your insights, especially as someone who has spent time in the homeland security business some 20 years as a fire department of New York firefighter, especially that we need to get back to truth-based threat assessments and strategies that counter the dangers that we're currently still having inflicting themselves upon us. Tim, again, thank you again for your service and for joining us as you do from time to time. Next up, we will be speaking with Kevin Freeman right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
I am delighted to say we are back with George Raisley. He is the editor of a marvelous publication, Conservative HQ. I'm fond of pointing out that he is a genius, a certified genius, according to his membership in American Mensa. He is also a veteran of some 300 political campaigns, including those of every Republican presidential candidate from 1976 to 2008. He has been, in short, around and knows official Washington both as a very, very clear-eyed observer, but also as a participant in some of its doings, notably in policy and communications positions in the House and Senate staff, and also worked on the staff of Vice President Dan Quayle during the George H.W. Bush administration. George is a good friend. We're always delighted to have him with us. George, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Frank. It's always great to be on the show with you.
Thank you. The pleasure is ours. So, George, you have just sent across the electronic transom an important piece about sort of your reflections on where we are post 9/11, some 17 years post 9/11 at that. I wanted you to share with your audience both your thinking on how this so-called war on terror is going, and what in particular it is that we're doing or not doing, as the case may be, that seems to leave no end in sight.
Well, I think that the most important thing that we're not doing is getting the enemy right. Establishment politicians and national security thinkers like to call it a war on terror when actually it's a war against Sharia supremacism, and it's a war that in essence Islam has declared on the West. And until we get the enemy right, we're not going to win it.
Yeah, I wish it were just the West. I mean, it's really the whole world that these guys have in their sights, and they're seeking, as you know, to achieve dominance upon them and to impose, as you say, this toxic Islamic doctrine called Sharia worldwide. And I'm so appreciative of you saying that, because it's certainly my conclusion, too, that we haven't been willing to come to grips with this reality. And it's not to say that it's easy, and especially given the degree to which there's a tendency to say, well, you will be offending all Muslims if you point out that sort of the genetic code of the faith, according to the authorities of the faith, not all Muslims, but according to the authorities of the faith, is this doctrine of Sharia. And George, you've, again, been around Washington for a long time. Do you see any possibility that we're going to start actually getting this right? Notably, I'm reminded Donald Trump said he was going to effect a course correction in this regard, and I think laid out some very sensible policy steps with respect to it during the course of the campaign. So where are we now on his watch?
Well, I would say, there have been some modest changes, but the big picture hasn't changed really much at all, because embedded in the Pentagon and, various other pieces of the Washington establishment is this whole baloney notion that, Islam is a religion of peace. And you've got this whole 8 years of Bush saying that, and then 8 years of Obama not only saying it, but purging anyone who disagreed. And consequently, all the people that were captains and majors when Bush was president, if they weren't purged, they're now the colonels and generals. And, they came up through the Obama system. And, frankly, they don't get it. And they've been trained not to get it.
Or certainly not trained to get it. And arguably that's been enforced. And this is really an important insight, George, enforced by the threats to their careers if they nonetheless somehow do get it, against all odds. And as you've been reflecting on this, George, this is a point that was made also, interestingly enough, by our previous guest, Tim Brown, who was a firefighter in NYPD's counterpart, the Fire Department of New York, that this training purge of both materials and trainers has really left us ill-equipped to, as you say, understand the enemy, let alone contend with it. Again, is there any indication that this is something that's being corrected by the Trump administration?
I wish I could say yes. And I think that, bringing John Bolton in as national security advisor and Mike Pompeo in at State were good signs, but I don't see any, you know, as an outside observer, I don't see any action in this regard. And the president has largely left this out of his rhetoric recently. I'm anxious to see if he says anything that might offer some encouragement in his remarks today. But so far, it's at least outwardly pretty much more of the same. You know, there are some small signs. I mean, closing down the PLO office, a good sign. But, you know, he hasn't designated the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. They haven't really changed a lot of the policies that became embedded in our government during the beginning in the Bush administration, and certainly became set in stone during the Obama years.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that business about the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. You know, we're told by a lot of people, George, that it's an organization that has eschewed violence. I think that was the word of Clapper, the now notorious former director of national intelligence. And on that basis, they were regarded, as you say, going back to the George W. Bush years, immediately after 9/11, right on through, of course, even worse during the Obama years, as partners of ours, people we could trust to help us counter those nasty, violent extremists who seemingly didn't have anything to do with Islam or Sharia at all. So when you say that it's a terrorist organization, why? And why is it so important to designate them as such?
Well, it's a terrorist organization because they say they're a terrorist organization. And when somebody says, I'm a terrorist, you should believe them. And the fact that they've eschewed violence would be a great surprise to many people living in the Middle East who have been the objects of the Muslim Brotherhood violence in Egypt and other places. Plus the fact that you can draw a pretty straight line between sort of starting out, if you will, in the Muslim Brotherhood and moving on to other more active measures organizations in the Sharia supremacist world. And so the Muslim Brotherhood is certainly the gateway for a lot of these militant, terrorism-oriented Sharia supremacists.
Right. In fact, it really spawned many of them through, you know, inculcating their leadership with this idea of Sharia supremacism. And I just want to thank you for your clarity on this subject and that of Tim Brown, for that matter, because I think that we have to get this right if there's to be any hope of actually prevailing over these enemies, foreign and domestic, by the way. As you know so well, the Brotherhood is very much operating in our own country, including inside the wire of our government. Speaking of our government and speaking of people inside the wire, George, another piece that I wanted to address with you was something you wrote at Conservative HQ earlier in the week about the New York Times belatedly discovering the deep state. And you make the point that they and many others were sort of poo-pooing the whole idea that there was such a thing until this anonymous article was published by the Times. Talk a little bit about what we mean by the term the deep state and what we've learned in recent days about its activities and their implications for our republic.
Well, many of us who have served in government, and you've been there and probably seen this as well in your years of service way back when, recognize that there's sort of a permanent bureaucracy that at least thinks they run things. And what we've discovered really since Trump's election is that it is worse than that, that there are people embedded in the government who, you know, not only think it's their job to get the parks open on time and get the Social Security checks out, no matter who's in charge in the White House, but who's they see their mission as thwarting particularly Republicans and conservatives in their policy decisions, duly elected president, duly elected Congress, being thwarted by these permanent governing class, if you will. And they're encouraged in this by the permanent political class that includes the media, certainly think tank leaders here in Washington, certain big donors to both parties, and the notion that they know better than the American people what the government ought to be doing it and how it should be doing it. And there's this article, which I found to be, well, it didn't ring true in some respects as coming from a senior level person, frankly. But let's take it on face value that it did. I mean, I have worked in elected and appointed positions at every level of government, from City Hall to the White House, and I found it to be utterly astonishing if it were, in fact, written by a senior official in the federal government. An act of treason would be a charitable description of it, frankly.
Yeah. We'll be visiting with you, I hope, in the near future. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us about it today, and come back to us again very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by one of the country's leading authorities on Korea, North and South. In particular, he is a specialist in matters involving North Korea, its abuse of human rights, the objectives and activities of this barbaric regime in Pyongyang that is not only brutalizing its own people, but increasingly threatening others in the region and even us. His name is Greg Scarlatou. He is the executive director of a committee for human rights in North Korea, a visiting professor at Hankuk University of Foreign Studies in Seoul. He's also an instructor and coordinator of the Korean Peninsula and Japan class at the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service Institute, and not least, the author and broadcaster of a weekly Korean language column, North Korea, for Radio Free Asia. Greg Scarlatou, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
The pleasure is all mine, Frank, as always.
Well, it's very much mine as well, particularly because we are speaking shortly after we've learned of a new letter from Kim Jong-un, the dictator, tyrant, and megalomaniacal ruler of North Korea, to our president, President Trump, suggesting that they get together again. And I want to talk with you a bit about that, the advisability of it. The president apparently is favorably disposed, and I'm told that preparations are now being made for a second summit between the two men. But before we get into all of that, Greg, I did want to talk about some developments on the Korean Peninsula, particularly south of the DMZ, and I guess you might say in the DMZ itself, that are, I must say, a bit worrying to me. Specifically, this idea that the South Korean president clearly has a kind of idée fixe to normalize relations with North Korea, to establish all kinds of liaison arrangements, including a facility in the DMZ, and it appears even to pursue rather aggressively the idea of reunification of the peninsula. Walk us through what's going on there with President Moon Jae-in.
Well, there have been several unilateral moves on the southern side. For example, guard posts have been removed from the DMZ. Some of the tank barriers have been removed. Some of the obstacles in the DMZ have been moved on the South Korean side. We're not sure. We don't know anything about reciprocation on the North Korean side. It seems that President Moon Jae-in and his government are in a mad rush to achieve some level of dialogue, reconciliation, perhaps. What he has mentioned on multiple occasions, especially during his campaign for president, a Korean confederation. This is a very rapid process that seems to have forgotten that the fundamental strategic objectives of the Kim regime have not changed, this regime has not changed. Its ultimate objective is survival. And clearly, if, for example, an offensive realist were to look at the Korean Peninsula situation, this is an absolute monopoly on power. There is no competition. The only competition is South Korea, the Republic of Korea, as preposterous as that might sound, acquiring a certain level of hegemony over the entire Korean Peninsula continues to be a top strategic objective of the Kim regime, conducive to the survival of that regime. So we all love peace, reconciliation, unification, but the ultimate measure of peace, reconciliation, unification of the Korean Peninsula must be the impact it has on the Korean people living in the South and the North.
And as things stand now, as you see it, Greg Scarlett, who is a serious student of and observer of these kinds of diplomatic activities and the strategic context in which they're taking place, is there any concern on your part that at the moment, the kinds of unilateral steps that Moon Jae-in's regime is taking, the kinds of concessions that seem to be in the offing, including restarting this joint enterprise in the demilitarized zone where this liaison facility is supposed to be reestablished, that under present circumstances, we may well see this being quite destabilizing, in the sense that it may seem to convey to the North Korean regime a new opportunity for aggressive behavior towards the South.
Indeed, this is quite destabilizing. And of course, the major stabilizing factor on the Korean Peninsula and beyond has been the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Now, fortunately, we haven't had indication that President Moon might intend to somehow weaken the alliance. We do hope that the South Korean government continues to remain committed to the alliance. But looking at the domestic situation of South Korea as well, there are very serious reasons to be worried. The South Korean economy is sputtering, and a lot of this has to do with the policies of the Moon government. Small and medium-sized businesses in particular have been affected by an increase in the minimum wage, by a reduction, a compulsory reduction, in the number of working hours. Now, of course, improving labor standards is a lofty goal, but this cannot be done so quickly. It cannot be done overnight. And quite frankly, I was there for a month, Frank, over the summer. I did not talk to one single South Korean who was happy with the state of the economy today. For the first time since 1997-98, since the days of the Asian financial crisis, I could see with my own eyes moms and pop shops, restaurants, convenience stores being closed down because they could not afford to run them anymore. So this is a quite serious situation, I would say.
Well, again, we're speaking with Greg Scarlett, the Executive Director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. And I guess while we're talking about perhaps anecdotal, impressionistic evidence, what is the attitude, as best you can judge it, Greg, of the South Korean people, not just towards the economy, but towards the political direction they're being taken by President Moon?
President Moon's popularity seems to have dropped like a cannonball since the first summit with Kim Jong-un. It was in the 80%. Now it's at 49%, still very high. Of course, we've seen this phenomenon happening to basically all previous South Korean presidents. But most definitely, his popularity is on the decline. This has to do with the somehow unjustified high hopes this South Korean administration had about the Kim regime in North Korea. It has to do especially with the economy. It has to do with the already high and ever-increasing rate of unemployment amongst young graduates of South Korean universities. So his popularity is clearly declining. He's heavily invested in this rapprochement process with North Korea. He's basically laid all of his bets, or most of his bets, on this process.
But again, does that mean that the process enjoys the support of the South Korean people? Is it your sense that they are on board with the kinds of risks that he is taking, that the concessions that he's making are broadly supported? Or may I put it slightly differently, is it true among perhaps the younger demographic within the polity of South Korea, but not among those of generations that actually remember what the North did to the South in the Korean War?
Frank, no, it is not true. And by saying that, I'm not taking sides in South Korean politics. I know that's part of the 101 class for the non-Korean observer, although I have been following Korean issues for 27 years. I lived there for 10 years. I have 2 degrees from Seoul National University. There is a silent pro-American, pro-capitalist majority in South Korea. And basically, I have to say that if there is such thing as mainstream media, they call themselves mainstream media, of course, in South Korea and elsewhere, they do not report or underreport demonstrations by South Korean conservatives who are deeply troubled by the ongoing situation in South Korea. They're deeply troubled in particular by the clearly unjustified speed of rapprochement with the Kim regime. They're also deeply worried about what is happening to South Korea's economy, and they're also deeply worried about what they regard as a purging of the conservative right under different pretexts.
Yeah, this really brings me to my last question. I am told, Greg, by Lawrence Peck, he's very exercised about the kind of people that President Moon has been surrounding himself with, namely people who are long-time champions of North Korea and of a very radical leftist sort of bent otherwise. And the president himself has some of those its historical leanings. Do you share that concern? And if so, given what you've said about the suggestion that he's somewhat out of touch now with the people of South Korea, is this teeing up to be really a crisis?
I am a student of what Lawrence Peck has to teach us about pro-North activities here in the United States and elsewhere. He has a very good point there. Unfortunately, the Korea watching community barely considers this to be a niche topic here. I think we should pay very close attention. I think the people of South Korea should wake up. And I think that the policy community, the think tank community in Washington, D.C. should also wake up.
Yeah. We are hard out of time, I'm sorry to say. Greg Scarlatou, thank you for your time today. George Raceley joins us next. We'll talk with him about, is 9/11 far from over, and the deep state, and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving economic warfare. His name is Kevin Freeman. He is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, the creator of GlobalEconomicWarfare.com and Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, the author also of two terrific and best-selling books, Game Plan and Secret Weapon. And Kevin, I want to say, in terms of welcoming you, I want to especially welcome you on the occasion of our remembrance of 9/11, because you have done more than just about anyone to call attention to and help explain what happened on 9/11 2008. Let's start there, shall we?
Well, I remember that well, Frank. On 9/11 2008, I got a call from a friend who was the chief investment officer at Wells Fargo, and he said, "Are you seeing what we're seeing?" And that was that beginning of that tumultuous week in which Lehman Brothers failed and literally the entire American financial system began to crack and crash. And what he was referring to was naked short selling, trading out of the Middle East through London to take down Lehman Brothers, to take down any American financial institution, but particularly those with the Jewish nature. Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers had all been under attack. But that week, the focus was on Lehman Brothers, and it was coming from mostly from Qatar.
And to the extent that this has not generally been recognized as the impetus behind Lehman Brothers' takedown, it's the subject of your book, Secret Weapon. But just walk us very quickly through how it was accomplished, Kevin, and who else seems to have been involved besides the Qataris?
Primarily, who was involved was the Qatari Sovereign Wealth Fund through Barclays Bank. Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund participated as well. But what we saw was a naked short selling attack, which is a complex Wall Street thing, basically says you're betting against the bank. They didn't have an ownership stake. They weren't borrowing shares as is normal. They just literally put these huge financial bets against the bank. And heading up the Qatari Sovereign Wealth Fund's Sharia compliance group was a man named Yusuf Qaradawi, who is a Muslim Brother senior guy. He's a bad dude. He has caused all kinds of problems. But we just know his intention was, I want to take down this Jewish investment bank and hopefully attack and bankrupt America. And you can pick that sense up from the press reports. But they put 100 million shares of Lehman Brothers for sale that they didn't own, and that undermined the bank to such a degree that it became an impossible save. And that triggered this massive collapse that we all experienced.
Kevin Freeman, we will not be able to do justice to this whole vehicle of naked short selling that they used to effect this kind of catastrophic impact on our economy, which, by the way, whether it was designed as such or simply had the knock-on effect, helped elect Barack Obama president of the United States, did it not? And what we're looking at, I guess, now is a question of, could this happen again or something like it? Could Donald Trump, a man who has, I think, rightly taken credit for having put the U.S. economy back in gear, find himself undone by a similar kind of attack? Who knows? Perhaps even in this election window as well.
Well, that would be, you know, something in the nature of a George Soros dream, I would think, that he wakes up, finds the stock market crash, and the net result of it is that President Trump is undermined in the one area that he points to most, which is how the American economy is recovering. Bill Maher mentioned this on one of his television programs. Wouldn't it be great if we saw a market crash? And the problem is Bill Maher doesn't know how to do it. George Soros, of course, does know how to do it. He's known as the man who broke the Bank of England.
Right. And George Soros was, as I recall, the man in the New York Times who confirmed basically your theory of what happened to Lehman Brothers. So he certainly knows his way around this business and has got the political motivation to do great harm to our country in the future, as he has in the past. Let me turn to China, because one of the players that we're told sat out that instance of economic warfare against the United States, despite the Russians importuning them to get into it, is Communist China, Kevin Freeman. And there's a lot going on with respect to China. Obviously, there's the so-called trade war or tariff versus tariff slugfest between the president and Xi Jinping. But give us a flavor of what else is going on that we should be alive to with respect to the Communist Chinese and their economic warfare program, among other things.
Well, you're right that they did sit out 2008. Thank God for China. Russia under Vladimir Putin wanted to crater our economy at that moment, and they weren't willing to go along with it. They felt the blowback would be too severe. But in 2013, it became official policy of the Chinese government to de-Americanize the world. They wanted to replace the Western financial system. They wanted to take the number one position, number one economy position of the world. And so from that moment forward, they have pushed every direction to replace what we see and what we are familiar with, the International Monetary Fund, the SWIFT transaction system, the rescue, the support of other countries. China has tried to take that preeminent position. And in doing so, they've been driven closer to Russia. They're doing military drills together. They have $100 billion in deals that they've just announced. But they're doing it very top-down. They're a data-driven society, according to MIT, and it is working for them, or it appears to be working for them at the moment, because they're literally going into Africa, they're going into Asia, they're going into all around the world with their top-down, data-driven approach. And the danger of this is they are communist China. They do not share common beliefs in liberty and so forth as we do, and their view of the world is in the ascendance.
And one, speaking of digital and data, the Chinese have made a feature of their imperialistic expansionism, as you know, Kevin Freeman, not only the build-out of a huge amount of infrastructure, particularly in the developing world, of the old-fashioned physical kind, ports and airfields and, you know, resource extraction operations and the like, but also digital infrastructure. And some have said this is the most ominous of all, especially when you combine the essentially permanent character of the dependency that will be created on that Chinese digital infrastructure for all of these countries, whether they manage to escape the debt trap, as it's called, or whether they, you know, remain enslaved by the Chinese, they will be dependent upon Chinese telecoms and other digital communications and systems going forward. And when you combine that, Kevin, with what the Chinese are doing to use data as a vehicle of control, what they call the social credit score, that is clearly ripe for export to some of these other authoritarian countries that are now partnering with them in the One Belt, One Road initiative. This is an ominous thing indeed, is it not?
Well, we have the problem here of potential shadow banning of conservatives by Twitter and Facebook and so forth. This would be taking it to an entirely new level where they completely control the information flow. They make up information. They rewrite history to make President Xi look good. And they're actually doing this. And Google at one point fought against this and said, oh, no, we can't participate in China. But they've been welcomed back into China, and they're agreeing to follow these government mandates.
Yeah, censorship among them.
Yes, and that will spread. It will spread, so the Chinese view of the world will be dominating what most people think, believe, act on. And they're not just doing it with control of information, but they're also doing it with scientific progress. I just read that a third of scientific papers that are produced in China, despite the fact that they only have 15% of world gross domestic product. They're leading in venture capital investments. They're leading in STEM graduates. Their control economy looks at the moment as if it's winning. Now, there are some underlying data problems that they have of their own. They've got debt problems. Their populace is not moving to consumption like they want to. You know, you can't control everything all the time. But at the moment, they are making a massive move to control the data flow of the world and to control that information to use it so that they can gain control, foothold, and leadership around the world.
Yeah. Kevin Freeman, thank you as always for your insights into all these matters. Keep up the good work, my friend. We'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.